Russ Poldrack asked me to give this talk, and I think in large part because over the last few years, he and I spent a lot of time discussing, debating exactly the questions that I'm going to go through today, which is really how do geneticists look at genetic association and consider results significant. And the reason I think why he asked me to do this is that in large part, we tend to look at things really quite differently from people who are doing MRI genetics and particularly fMRI genetics. And I just want to give a minute of disclaimer, which is that although I'm giving this talk, I'm not a statistician. I sort of feel like this commercial that there used to be with this guy who played Marcus Welby, MD, on TV, and then he was in these commercials saying, "I'm not a doctor, but I played one on TV." And I think that's about the relationship that I have to statistics. But the real questions that that I'm going to try to get into really don't have to be dealt with at a technical level. I think they're really more at a conceptual level. And the timing is really good. Some of you may have seen in last week's, or I guess 2 weeks ago, Nature, a news feature on the on the topic of psychiatric genetics, the brains of the family. And there was sort of this subheading: is the difficulty in finding genes responsible for mental illness reflecting the complexity of genetics or the poor definition of psychiatric disorders? And essentially, though, what the feature was about the completely conflicting views on this topic of people who are approaching it. Is that me? Am I doing something?
Your cell phone's in your pocket.
Aha. Sorry about that. The damn blackberries. Okay. And essentially what it was talking about was the conflict between people who approach this topic from a geneticist standpoint and people who approach this topic particularly from the standpoint of MRI research. And so there was this counterposing of the statement that the problems that we've had so far, that the studies so far are statistically underpowered, we need bigger studies, and this is, of course, increasingly the way geneticists are thinking, larger and larger studies, more and more coverage of the genome and larger samples. And the response to this from Danny Weinberger at NIH was simply, geneticists know nothing about psychiatric disease. And the implication was also about neuroscience more generally. And so, you know, what is the problem and why do geneticists have this viewpoint about it? So I think there's no question that psychiatric disorders, and I think nervous system traits in general, many of them are very highly heritable. It's also the case that up to this point, there is not a single psychiatric susceptibility gene that geneticists would consider really identified and validated. That is, that basically anything that people think that they have identified as a gene related to psychiatric disorders, most geneticists would dispute. And why we think that there is been this failure so far is that the studies so far are really tremendously underpowered. That is, they've studied phenotypes that are of uncertain validity, for example, psychiatric disease diagnoses. The samples have been too small, and they've covered too few components of the genome to really say that they've really adequately conducted genetic association to particular traits. And the signal-to-noise ratio in general has been far too low, both because of the fact that there's substantial genetic heterogeneity, lots of different genetic variants that probably combine to compose most nervous system traits, and substantial non-genetic heterogeneity, that is, a number of different environmental influences, most of which we really can't study, much less quantify. And so the real issue that starts dividing geneticists and, let's say, neuroscientists when it comes to genetic association studies, particularly relating to MRI, is really the debate between whole genome studies and single candidate gene studies. And this is yet another quote from the same article from Steve Hyman, who was the director of NIMH, which is that we're really just too ignorant of underlying neurobiology to make guesses about candidate genes. And I think this really does reflect the geneticist's viewpoint, and I think there's a lot of evidence to support it. For example, and by the way, this is not a topic which is unique to studies of the nervous system. It's a topic which really has has sort of been pervasive in thinking about genetic associations to complex traits through all of biomedical research, except in most other areas of biomedical research, the debate's now been resolved in favor of the need for whole genome studies. But you can see, as of a few years ago, this is a compilation that Joel Hirshhorn put together. At that time, there were only six in all of biomedical science, six gene disease associations that had been found to be statistically significant in what you might consider a reasonable majority of studies. And so again, at this point, there's really very few that were identified. And some of these were ones that had such whopping effects. For example, the relationship of the CCR5 receptor to susceptibility to AIDS, that they really provide very little guide to genetic association of complex traits in general. And furthermore, not only do we not know what are good candidate genes, we don't have a good enough understanding of the biology to propose them, but even when we have a gene that we can investigate, it's really very hard for us to say what a good candidate variant is. And so this is a slide that actually is now an aggregation, now that we've really had a pretty good experience with genome-wide association studies of a wide range of different complex traits, as to what the associated SNPs that are found clearly now substantially validated associations. And what you see is that the things that would be obvious variants for candidate gene studies, those that are in the 5' or 3' regions surrounding genes, or much less the coding sequence variants, which represent a very, very small number of the associations that have been identified by now. And by far the greatest majority are those that are in non-coding sequences of genes, or even more to the point, that are completely outside of genes and that we have no idea at all why or to what they're associated with at the biological level. So I think it really shows that our ability to pick a single variant for a candidate gene study is very poor, when more than 90% of the truly associated variants at this point are not ones that we would ever have been able to pick under any kind of candidate approach. And so this is why geneticists have turned over the last 20 years, but increasingly over the last few years, to genome-wide mapping. And this slide really shows what the result is, again, mostly outside of nervous system studies. But what's shown here are the known, clearly validated gene variants associated with common traits. As you can see, for several years before genome-wide association studies were available, there were really very few known. But as you can see, once genome-wide association studies were done, well-powered, with large samples and adequate numbers of markers, we now have hundreds clearly validated associations. This is a slide as of 2007. I believe that as of now, it's probably somewhere up here. So there's no question that this approach works for virtually every trait for which it's been tried. And this is really, you know, aside from all the theoretical reasons, this is the main reason why geneticists so strongly advocate the need for this approach. And so what I'm going to try to do over the next few minutes is really to go through what are the principles from a genetic standpoint of genome-wide mapping, and then, again, not getting really into the statistics, but really more from a conceptual level, the way that we think about statistics, and then move from there to specific examples. And so really, all genome-wide mapping goes back to the principle of genetic linkage. This is probably an example of the kind of slide that Tom was talking about that put them to sleep in graduate school.
This is what we didn't get.
And really, it goes back to Mendel's basic laws of segregation and independent assortment in meiosis. That that all of our genome occurs in the context of paired chromosomes, of which we have 23, and that in meiosis, these separate or segregate and then come back together. And the point that Mendel realized in looking at peas, and that has now been shown in every other organism in which sexual reproduction occurs, is that when meiosis brings the chromosomes back together, the likelihood that two pieces of genome will have remained together, that is, will have assorted together, is directly related to how close together they are. So, for example, if you have two different chromosomes, you know, as I said, we have 23, they will assort completely independently. That is, the maternal and paternal pairs coming together will occur completely differently between chromosome A here and chromosome B. You could either get, here is showing, let's say, maternal and the paternal chromosome for chromosome A, maternal and paternal one for chromosome B, and it's really completely random whether in the offspring of this meiosis, whether maternal and maternal stay together or whether maternal and paternal go together for different chromosomes. So the idea of independent assortment really showed that you could tell how close together two pieces of DNA were based on how they segregated and then reassorted after meiosis occurred. And this is just filling in the text of that. So we use this for all forms of this basic rule for all forms of genetic mapping analysis. So what we're doing in any kind of genetic mapping, whether it's using linkage analysis or association analysis, is taking some group of individuals that are in our study population that have a trait of interest, whether this be a disease or whether this be a quantitative measure, let's say an extreme finding on fMRI. And we have the assumption, if there is a genetic basis to the trait that they share in common, that they will have inherited the predisposition to that trait from some common ancestor, and that this common ancestor introduced into the population that we're now studying the variant that is responsible for the trait or that contributes to the trait and the chromosome on which that variant lies. And we call the region that surrounds this gene or variant of interest a region of identity by descent, or IVD. And again, this is making use of Mendel's law, which is that if pieces of DNA are near to each other, they will travel together across meiosis, across generations. But the farther apart they are, the more likely that they will start to split apart as more generations, as more meiosis occur. And so, for example, if our group of individuals that we were studying were here just a couple of generations after the founding of this population, where this individual brings the gene into the population, they would share a much larger region, IVD, around the gene of interest than if they're 100 or 1,000 generations, as might be in the population, like, let's say, the population of Los Angeles. And so what we're trying to do in all genetic mapping studies is try to identify the gene or gene variant of interest by virtue of the fact that we expect that there's some probability greater than chance that the individuals with the trait we're interested in will be sharing identically some region of chromosome that surrounds the gene of interest. And again, the size of this region which remains shared is directly proportional to the number of generations since these individuals are separated from their common founder. And so how do we actually identify these regions of IVD? This is by use of what we call genetic markers. And a genetic marker is really just a piece of DNA of known genome location, which we know to be variable in the population. And so this is just a cartoon showing chromosome with the nucleotides H, C, T, and G running along the chromosome. And we see that there's one spot, see in most of the spots, there's no variation along this chromosome, but there's one spot where there's been a mutation at some time in the past such that most of the people in the population, say, may have a T base at this location, but a small number of individuals here, it's shown to be about 6%, have a G base at this location. And so if we have a technical means of looking at all of the DNA and finding the places of variability, we can actually then identify these regions of identity by descent in a group of individuals by seeing where are these individuals showing the same DNA structure where other individuals in the population may be variable. Okay? And so these variations occur very frequently in the genome. This is called a single nucleotide polymorphism. There are many other kinds of variation. So single nucleotide polymorphism, or SNP, exists every 100 to 300 base pairs. So in the 3 billion base pairs of the genome, you can see that there's millions and millions of SNPs. We now have identified many millions of these SNPs, and we have information on the frequency of these variants in different populations, and we now have technology that makes it easy for us to recognize these in very, very large samples. And so as a result of knowing all this variation, we can do genetic analysis looking at the relationship between traits and particular regions of the genome. And so, again, what we're doing is this principle is based on this principle of genetic linkage, the principle based on Mendel's laws of independent assortment, saying that if pieces of DNA are close together or linked, they will travel together across meiosis. If they're far apart or unlinked, they will independently assort. And so whether we're doing linkage analysis or association analysis on a genome-wide basis, in general, it's based on this principle of genetic linkage, which I showed in the previous cartoon about the identity by descent regions in the genome. And so the difference between linkage analysis and association analysis is really pretty straightforward. Linkage analysis is looking within families and is searching for regions of the genome where affected individuals within the family share alleles more than would be expected by chance. Whereas association analysis, just like any other association analysis for any other kind of measure, is just comparing the frequency of allele differences, which again is from the standpoint of the analysis no different than any other kind of differences of an attribute in a population, in this case between usually cases and controls. And again, although the analysis is really quite different, from a conceptual standpoint in terms of the principle of genetic linkage, they represent just two ends of a continuum. So again, going back to the figure that I showed you of the SNP variation, where you could have either a G or a T base at a particular location in the genome. So for example, in linkage analysis, what we can see is that the individuals shown in this pedigree, the ones who are darkened, indicating that they have the trait we're interested in, you can see that all the individuals with the trait are carrying a copy of the uncommon variant, the G variant, and that this is being transmitted with the trait across generations. And so this is a good indication, if this is a large enough pedigree and we see this transmission enough for it to be statistically significant, which I'll talk about in a moment, this will be an indication that this variant with known chromosome location is genetically linked, i.e. is nearby in the genome, to the gene responsible for the trait of interest. It's traveling in the family with the G variant. Association analysis, on the other hand, is, as I mentioned, it's really just looking in a population setting at individuals, let's say, who have a trait and control individuals, and is just looking at the frequency differences of this allele compared to the T allele. And the analysis itself is really no different from any other association analysis in a case control setting. But again, it's reflecting the principle of linkage. And so this is sort of showing, again, in the linkage situation where you're doing linkage analysis in a pedigree, here it's expanded the pedigree, you can see that we see, you know, transmission of a trait in a very defined pedigree where we can look at all of these relationships, we can genotype all of these individuals and see whether they're passing along a particular variant that may or may not be linked with the trait of interest. But what we're doing in a population setting is we're looking at the individuals at the bottom who we take to be unrelated, and therefore we're doing association analysis. But in some way, we're supposing that if we could really trace the pedigree of the entire population, we would really be looking at the same principle of linkage, of transmission of the trait of interest with genetic variants from some founder down to the present. So conceptually, at the biological level, we're looking at the same thing, but from the standpoint of analysis, we're looking at something quite different, looking at differences between cases and controls in a population setting, as opposed to measuring transmission within a pedigree. So now to turn from the principle of linkage to how we determine if genetic loci are significantly linked. So we use very stringent significant thresholds, both for linkage analysis and association analysis, and really based on sort of two different arguments, one based on a more Bayesian argument, one based more on a frequentist argument. And so on the one hand, we start with the idea that taking any two loci chosen at random in the genome, there's a very low prior probability that those two will be linked. So we have some gene of interest and some trait. Out of all the genes in the genome, we consider very, very unlikely that they're going to be linked. And really, this is the primary way that the geneticists thought of the probability of linkage when there were relatively few genetic markers in the genome. That is, before we had this entire saturation of SNPs that we have now. And once we started developing many markers, it really sort of also the stringency argument also rested on the idea that many, many, many tests were involved in genotyping studies. You're considering many, many markers, and therefore you're having to correct for a very large number of tests. And what turns out to be the case, though, is using this argument or this argument, you really get approximately the same idea of what's considered a significant a threshold for considering linkage results significant, which is that the log score, the log base 10 of likelihood ratio is greater than about 3, i.e. a p-value representing this is less than about 10 to the minus 4th. And so again, going from the standpoint of the Bayesian way of thinking about it, geneticists thought that you could assign a prior probability of linkage between any two random genes in the genome of about 0.02. And this largely rests on the fact that you have 23 different chromosomes. You know that if two loci are on different chromosomes, they are by definition unlinked and will travel apart. But even loci that are opposite ends of the same chromosome are for practical purposes unlinked. So taking the length of the genome, this is really a pretty close approximation of what the prior probability of any two genes picked at random from the genome, whether that be a disease-related gene or a genetic marker, being linked. And so therefore, if you use Bayes' theorem to obtain a posterior probability of linkage greater than 0.95, that is, at the end of the day, if you want to have less than 5% false positive linkages, and you solve for the likelihood ratio of the probability of the data under linkage compared to the probability of the data under no linkage, the likelihood ratio must be greater than about 1,000, i.e. a log score of greater than 3, or p-value of less than about 10 to the minus 4th. Similarly, when you think about the significance thresholds for linkage, considering the need to control for multiple testing, if you think that you have, let's say, now complete genome marker sets so that there's a prior probability that some marker in the genome is linked to the trait we're interested in with a probability of 1, it turns out that about, for the standpoint of linkage and families, about 500 fully informative independent markers make up the complete genome. That is, if you have many more than that, then the markers themselves will be so linked with each other as to no longer be independent. And so if you think about it from this standpoint, to control for false positives at a 5% level, the global hypothesis being no linkage anywhere in the genome, basically you have to correct for 0.05 over 500 and get a p-value of 10 to the minus 4th for each test, i.e. approximately the same log score greater than 3. And so Lander and Kruglak about 12 years ago sort of looked at the need to really establish thresholds that the field could use to really be able to agree on whether linkages were really meaningful or not. And they came up with this idea of three different categories, essentially: suggestive linkage, significant linkage, and highly significant linkage. And essentially based on the expectation of what level of evidence you would need to expect to have a false positive occur by chance once in a whole genome scan, to have given log score expected to occur by chance 0.05 times in a whole genome scan, again, what they consider significant linkage, or to consider it even sort of less likely that a given log score would be expected to occur by chance at 0.001 times in a whole genome scan. And they came up with these different significance thresholds. And one of the reasons why this really took is that it really turned out to be very predictive of replicatable results, which is that there were very, very few instances of highly significant linkage that haven't really been validated now by being replicated in many studies. And as the log score of studies has gone down to significant to suggestive linkage, the vast majority you begin to find are not replicated and really haven't held up. They consider confirmed linkage. If you've achieved significant linkage in a first study, basically the idea would be that you would need lower level of evidence in a subsequent study. So basically they consider confirmed linkage in a replication to be the case where you would need evidence that was equivalent to the expectation of finding a log score of that value 0.01 times by chance in a search of the specific region shown linked in the original study. So again, just as I was mentioning at the beginning when I was talking about genome-wide association studies, what's really informed the use of these thresholds is that they were so predictive of the validity of linkage results. So the field began to move from linkage to association analysis because it turned out that as we became interested in genetically mapping more and more complex traits, that is, traits for which we have not just one or a few genes that are expected to have a large effect, but many, many different genetic variants, each with small effect, combining to contribute to the trait of interest, it turned out that association analysis is much, much more powerful than linkage analysis. And again, sort of just to remind, what we're looking at and the reason why this is so is that it's much, much more likely that we'll be able to sort of identify a population with large numbers of individuals with a trait compared to controls when there are many, many genes of small effect acting on it than we are to actually see the segregation of that trait within a given family. If there's hundreds of different genes, each of which are playing a very small part that are required to develop this trait, you're very unlikely to see this pattern of inheritance that you would expect to see in order to do linkage analysis. And so there are really two very different approaches to doing association analysis. All of them have the goal of identifying candidate genes. You know, we talk a lot about candidate gene studies, and again, all of the approaches to association analysis have the goal of finding candidate genes. It's really how we get there and how we consider what a candidate gene is that's different. And so what I'm going to mostly talk about in the next few minutes are what we call indirect association studies. This is where we're looking at genetic variants based on their position in the genome. This is like the SNPs that I was showing on the chromosome cartoon earlier, and where the analysis of these SNPs depends on what's called linkage disequilibrium or LD analysis, which I'll explain in a moment. And in contrast, direct association analysis is exactly what it says. It's looking directly at candidate variants, let's say either variants that have been chosen because we have some prior hypothesis that gene X is involved in a given trait, or even genome-wide. Let's say we have a plan to study all of the genes in the genome that have mutations in the coding region or variants in the coding region that we can use for association studies. And so what we mean by linkage disequilibrium or LD analysis is really the fact that SNPs that are very, very close together in the genome, again, the principle of linkage. But what we find is that when they're really, really very close together in the genome, that the alleles at one SNP tend to be very, very correlated with the alleles at nearby SNPs. And so this is just essentially showing this. This is one particular gene that's been very studied in relationship to diabetes, a gene called TCF7L2. And what's shown are the levels of correlation between neighboring SNPs within this gene. And what you can see is that basically, and these are the different SNPs sort of arrayed along this diagram. What you can see is that some of the SNPs are very, very, very highly correlated with each other. That is, if you know the identity of one SNP, it's very, very likely that you can predict the identity of the SNP nearby it. And as a result of that, you can also imagine, let's say that there are some gene variants that haven't been identified and that haven't been typed in your population. So let's say that the gene that we're really interested in, or the variant that we're really interested in, lies between these two SNPs. We haven't typed this variant of interest in our population, but the chances are very, very good that we can predict the allele at that variant of interest by having typed these SNPs that are around it and that are so highly correlated with them. But one of the things that turns out to be the case, and this really becomes very important in practical designs, this is showing LD in two different populations. Up here, a population from Iceland, and here a population from West Africa, with the same sets of SNPs being looked at here. And what you can see is that the same SNPs are very, very poorly correlated for the most part in this African population, even when they're very, very highly correlated in the European population. And so it's really showing that it becomes a much more complicated question, design of a study, what population you're using. And this really relates to all association studies. So indirect association studies involve genotyping a dense map of SNPs, again, both coding and non-coding regions. And what we're doing is we're assuming that the risk polymorphism that we're interested in, even if we haven't genotyped it directly, that it will be in very tight linkage disequilibrium with other SNPs. So the advantage of this approach, which is really the one that's most widely used now, is that we don't need to determine the functionality of genetic variation. We can just type variants across the genome and assume that we'll be able to infer the status at the functional variants. But the disadvantage, of course, is that this requires genotyping a very large number of SNPs. And in contrast, direct association, let's say where we have some idea of candidate SNPs, like SNPs in coding regions, the change amino acids, let's say we have then some other functional variants, let's say ones that we believe are having some biological effect in promoter regions. This has the advantage that there may be a relatively small number of such variants that we need to type, but the disadvantage is that that we really are probably missing most of the unknown and very important variants that, for example, regulate gene expression. And this goes back to a slide I showed at the beginning, which indicated that very, very few of the SNPs that we find association with in indirect association studies are ones that we would have picked to be candidate SNPs. So now finally to get to really the point of the talk and why Russ asked me to do it, which is why do genetic association studies need such stringent significant thresholds? And it's really the same essential logic as for linkage. First, there's a low prior probability of association to any given gene. You know, similar logic to that we had of the low probability of linkage between any two given genes. There are 20,000 to 30,000 human genes in the genome. Let's say we're interested in nervous system traits. The vast majority of these are expressed in the brain, and so something being expressed in the brain doesn't really make it a particularly good hypothesis as being related to a nervous system trait, since this will probably include somewhere between 15 and 18,000 genes. And we have very, very few good hypotheses that would change this low prior probability of association to any given gene. And I think this may be the single greatest point of dispute between, let's say, the Weinberger school that says that geneticists don't understand psychiatry or neuroscience and the way geneticists would look at it. Similarly, there's the same issue of multiple testing. We have to correct for a very, very large number of tests. Each independent polymorphism is essentially another association test. And in many studies, we're not just doing association to one particular phenotype, but for many phenotypes together, and each of those is creating yet another test. And so I think you can think about significant thresholds, again, from the same logic that we were talking about for linkage. So considering a simple Bayesian argument, the prior probability that a random gene is associated with a trait would be about 1 over 30,000, assuming 30,000 genes in the genome. Using the same calculations that I described earlier for linkage, in this case, the likelihood ratio would need to be greater than about 550,000 for association to be significant. That is, a posterior probability of greater than 0.95. And with a chi-square test, this would mean a p-value would have to be less than about 3 times 10 to the minus 7. I think if anyone's really interested in this, this is a very useful paper to look at by Wachholder et al., essentially taking the Bayesian argument into a more complete evaluation, where they consider not just the low prior probability, but in looking at specific studies, the importance of both power and the significance level in relationship to posterior odds. And so I think that the thing that really that they showed very nicely in this article is really that the threshold really depends on what your expectations of effect sizes and the sample size that you're using. And they really, I think, made a very good point that has really guided the development of genome-wide association studies of complex traits, that is, in contrast to what many people's first thought would be, that in fact less well-powered studies actually need much more stringent thresholds to control false positive rate than much larger well-powered studies. And again, because of the fact that because they're so much less well-powered, the prior expectation of association is so much lower. And again, I think this is one of the things that really drives geneticists into very large sample sizes in contrast to a lot of the candidate gene studies done in neuroscience studies. Also, from the standpoint of controlling for multiple testing, if you just think of it at the most conservative level in terms of Bonferroni correction, where basically you'd be multiplying the threshold of 0.05 times the number of SNPs being tested and the number of traits. So for a single trait with the million SNPs that essentially represent genome-wide SNP coverage, this would indicate a significance threshold of p less than 5 times 10 to the minus 8 for genome-wide significance. It's slightly more complicated because of the linkage disequilibrium that I mentioned between SNPs. The SNPs are not all independent, so there is something less than a million tests that we're doing, but it's really not easy for us to exactly quantitate it. But also, LD varies both across the genome and across populations, as I showed you in that other slide. And so this isn't an exact relationship that you can apply for findings from all parts of the genome in any different population. And similarly, just as the SNPs are not all independent, traits that you're looking at are not all independent as well. There's usually some correlation between the different traits in the study. And so while this probably represents an extreme, it probably doesn't represent an extreme by more than an order of magnitude. Because of the fact that this is considered, I think, generally such a conservative standard, increasingly thresholds are being considered in terms of the false discovery rate, that is the proportion of false positives among all positives, with the idea that if we actually now have 20 really, really exciting hits, it wouldn't be so bad if one of them turned out to be false. And I think, again, that's sort of the compromise that most genome-wide association studies are using. So in the last few minutes now, to sort of turn this back to current neurobehavioral genetic studies looking both at single candidate genes and genome-wide association. So I'm going to do this this little discussion in terms of one biological system, monoamine neurotransmitters, as most neuroscientists are familiar with, in large part because of the importance of these molecules in psychopharmacologic agents, both legal and illegal. These have been the molecules that have been most studied in relationship to neurobehavior, norepinephrine, histamine, serotonin, and dopamine, with their attendant functions. Because of the fact that we've known so much about these molecules and their synthesis and degradation pathways, so for example, the molecules that are involved in these pathways have been, in large part, the most prominent candidate genes used both in psychiatric candidate gene association studies, in MRI association studies, and so forth, like DBH, COMT, MAO, and so forth. As we learned more about these, we started looking at the receptors for the catecholamines. We started looking at the transporters. And so I'm going to talk for a few minutes about one gene that has been particularly widely studied, the human serotonin transporter gene. It's been studied both from the standpoint that it made sense as a functionally important molecule, but also very early on, a polymorphism was determined in the promoter region of this gene, so that there was a short and a long allele that were easy to resolve back in the days when the technology was not so good. So this has been something that people could do for almost 20 years. And there was some suggestion that there was a functional difference in the expression of this gene between the short allele and the long allele. And so this gene has been studied now probably in hundreds and hundreds of different association studies. And this is a slide that I made about 6 years ago for a wide variety of traits that had been studied in association with this gene. And what you can see is that there's really no pattern as to whether studies found significant association to this gene as not. In fact, they're by a large measure more non-significant than significant studies using this gene. And again, this is now probably something like tenfold as many studies, and the same general pattern holds, that even though there have been some extraordinarily highly publicized association studies of this variant, that by far the majority of studies have shown no effect whatsoever. So I'm just going to focus on personality traits, which, as, again, as you can see, there's really no indication that this is significant in the majority of studies. And I'm going to focus specifically on temperament. And so Robert Cloninger's hypothesis about temperament was that there were independent temperament dimensions and that different monoaminergic systems were related to different dimensions. So the dopamine systems were thought to be related to novelty seeking, serotonin-related systems were thought to be related to harm avoidance, related to anxiety, noradrenergic systems were thought related to reward dependence. And again, this is just showing, you know, that there were these very nicely quantitated dimensions that he developed for temperament, where you could really distinguish between high and low scores. And about 12 years ago, this paper appeared in Science, the Association of Anxiety-Related Traits. This is the harm avoidance trait from Cloninger's system with this polymorphism, the serotonin transporter gene. In this study, there were two samples used with a total of about 500 individuals, single variant association of the harm avoidance with a p-value of about 0.02, which again, geneticists even at the time probably wouldn't have considered very significant. Again, relating to this point about the importance of power in terms of the expectation of significance of association studies I talked about a minute ago, we set out to do a study to try to look even just with a single variant to see what we would find with a really well-powered study. We took a population called the Northern Finland Birth Cohort. There's all the individuals born in Northern Finland in a particular year. There were 600,000 individuals in this population, and there were about 10,000 births. And so at age 31, all the individuals that were left in the cohort gave blood samples for DNA and took Cloninger's inventory. And what we found when we genotyped this sample with the this polymorphism, the serotonin transporter, is that we found absolutely no association between genotype at this variant and the trait of harm avoidance. Exactly what we expected, but now I think showing it finally in a well-powered study so that we could really sort of come to some conclusion about it. And this, of course, led us to undertake the same association study, the same trait, temperament. Actually, I think I'll skip over this next bit here. In a genome-wide association analysis of this Northern Finland birth cohort, so we're here studying 5,000 individuals with more than 300,000 polymorphisms. I won't get into the actual analysis here in the interest of time. But before doing the study, we could show that the power for genome-wide association studies of quantitative traits, if you assumed even fairly modest heritability values for the traits, the red is showing areas where you have a very high probability of finding significance at a genome-wide level. And so the difference between these different points of the figure are the underlying heritability of the trait, and we looked at things which were almost non-heritable, with a heritability of less than 3%, to even things that were, again, still pretty modest, up to 10%. And what you can see is that for alleles of different frequency in a genome-wide study like this, for most the space here, that there was a very, very high probability of finding significant association. Just to go back outside of nervous system traits for a minute to show that, that this approach really works, this is the same population doing genome-wide association study of metabolic traits. And what you can see is that there are many different, all these points with blue lines are showing areas where we find clear genome-wide association levels of 10 to the minus 7th or less. And you can see that for many of these metabolic traits, there are several places in the genome where we find clearly significant association, HDL, LDL, triglycerides, and so forth. When we do the TCI, this temperament measure, you can see we don't see quite the same level of association that we see for the metabolic traits. Again, these are much more complicated traits, but much, much more significant association than we see in the candidate gene study. So even in this single population, for example, here we see 9 different loci associated with harm avoidance at a p less than 10 to the minus 5th. If you get into the level of association that are seen, let's say, in the original paper in Science for the serotonin transport, you find that you find 500 different locations in the genome that are showing greater evidence of association than that particular variant that's now been studied in over 1,000 different studies. And so, to conclude, how does this relate to association studies of MRI, people are most interested in? So I'm going to just take a single example of a candidate association study, again using the serotonin transporter from Weinberger's group, and this is a study that probably a lot of people here are more familiar with than I am. It's an association of a particular fMRI task and serotonin transporter, which is showing difference in what's said to be amygdala response to a particular set of pictures, which I'll show in the next slide, that differs supposedly between the two alleles, the long allele and the short allele, at the serotonin transporter. This is the paradigm. It's essentially, again, trying to tap into this idea that the serotonin system is related to fear. And what you see with this small sample is what we would consider a very modest nominal association, p less than 0.01. And again, at a level that, that geneticists would generally think was likely to be a false positive. So we have a little bit of a problem, which is that I've already indicated the genome-wide association study of neurobehavioral traits may require very, very large samples, which may be impractical for fMRI. And this is just showing, for example, for psychiatric traits, the size of the kind of studies that people are doing now. For example, studies of bipolar disorder with 7,000 patients and 10,000 controls, study of depression with 13,000 patients and 10,000 controls. Clearly, these are not studies that the one's going to be able to do with fMRI. And so are there any alternatives? And I think it's actually a fairly old example right at this point, but I think it's still a really good example of how this is still going to develop. And so Alzheimer's disease is an example where we already know very clearly one unquestionable genetic association, which is to the APOE gene. This is a gene that was initially identified some years ago before we could do genome-wide association studies. What you can see here in this genome-wide association study of pretty decent size of Alzheimer's patients and controls, the APOE gene is still the one that stands out from the whole rest of the genome, with here in this single study a p-value of something like 10 to the minus 40. So really an unquestionable association, genome-wide level significance. And so I go back to a study that Susan Buchheimer and her colleagues from UCLA did now almost 10 years ago, where they did fMRI in normal subjects who were at genetic risk for Alzheimer's disease based on APOE allele status. And so they used fMRI to identify changes in brain function prior to significant cognitive decline, which they hoped would predict outcome. So again, they took individuals with what was considered the low-risk genotype, APOE3, versus the high-risk APOE4 genotype. in very healthy volunteers. At that point, they were completely normal cognitive testing. And what they showed is that based on the fMRI observations, that you could really clearly distinguish between the individuals who had the low risk genotype and the individuals with the high risk genotype. So obviously this is a fairly small study and you're not seeing very low p-values of the kind that we see in a genome-wide association study. But I think the important point here is that the prior probability of an association here is really completely different than what we see in the typical candidate gene study. We've already shown that this variant is hugely associated with cognitive decline in Alzheimer's disease. And so, so basically, geneticists would give much more credence to this finding than they would to a single candidate gene finding. And similarly, some structural findings where they can, in the same population, relate cortical thickness to the presence of the E3 versus the E4 allele in the same group of at-risk individuals. So the summary of the way I look at this is, what I think is important to recognize is that genetic association studies do require stringent statistical thresholds. And this is true whether you're looking at one variant or a million. And as a result of what we know is that single candidate gene studies have a very low probability of being true positives. And again, it's not just from a theoretical standpoint. We can see this in the fact that we see such little replication of these studies. And in contrast, we see the spectacular results for large-scale, very well-powered genome-wide studies, where we see things being replicated at p-values of 10 to the minus 8th or less, now in hundreds of different cases. And at least until intensive phenotyping studies like MRI find a way of becoming more automated or higher throughput, it probably is not going to be the case that we're going to be able to do very large-scale genome-wide studies using them. We still have the need to consider them in this stringent statistical way. And so therefore, I think at least in the next few years or the next period of time, I think that the way in which we're going to need to get adequate power from these studies is using multi-stage designs of the type that I mentioned for the Alzheimer's and APOE study. And so you can imagine that as we start finding significant associations in genome-wide studies for a number of the traits that we're interested in relating to MRI, that we will be able to construct such two-stage or multi-stage studies using a number of different MRI paradigms. So thanks.
So questions? Back here? Back?
So I have two questions. The first one is, in your study of the fragment that you was to study, did you find any genome-wide
Yeah, so it's not. It's. I mean, I'm actually showing you something that's not published yet, so we find things that are at the what we would consider the border of genome-wide significance at levels of about 10 to the minus 7, and 10 to the minus 7.
It went from 9 for how long was this?
It's probably I think 3 at the level of 10 to the minus 7. We won't consider those validated, obviously, until we see them in other populations.
And another question relates to the fact that, what about the notion that given that we use imaging as the phenotype, given that it's closer to the biological basis, technically the sample size that we require is a lot smaller than going for something like harm avoidance, which has so many built-in behavioral variables?
Yeah, so I mean, I think this gets to the initial point that I was making that I said was really the big point of contention, which is that our way of looking at what type of evidence decreases or increases the prior probability above a random spot in the genome is that that you really have to have some way of quantitating it and having it in a way that can be validated. So, for example, if you've already seen a significant linkage in this particular location, you know, we would say that, okay, that gives you a reason to say that that you're closer to the biology. But I think that the fact that we haven't yet really got these studies replicated in a way that that we are seeing for these genome-wide studies, even for traits, you know, outside of the nervous system, which are probably quote-unquote much further away from biology than people would say MRI is, I think makes us think that that really, that argument isn't very well proven yet.
There's another question on this side.
Yeah, so you said that you could require less sample sizes if you look at more genes, you know, together as sort of like a haplotype or instead of a candidate gene. Was that correct? So there would be greater power between your quantitative trait and your genetics? I'm leading into, you know, we need about 1,000 people, I guess, to do a genome-wide association. So would we need even more than that, in your opinion, to do candidate gene association?
Well, I think the thing with candidate gene associations is that yeah, it's an interesting, I haven't thought about it from that standpoint. I mean, I think that the prior probability of candidate genes is so low that you probably, I mean that's right. I think that what you're saying is right. If you got really, really large samples, you probably could then see very, very small effects possibly at the end that you could consider significant. My guess is, though, that that those would be such small biological effects that you wouldn't be interested in them.
I had one subtle point about the plots. You showed power as a function of allele frequency, and so that's, I mean, just a basic point that's important even when doing candidate analyses, you know, looking at the allele frequency. But then you have quantitative trait frequency. I was confused. I was thinking.
I'm sorry, I shouldn't have turned this off. Which one was it?
The heat map.
Oh, okay, yeah. So,
what was on the x-axis?
Yeah. So on the x-axis was the frequency of the frequency of the variant. So, if you...
What was on the y-axis? I thought that was on the y-axis.
Let me pull that, sorry. Yeah, yes. I'm not recommending it to anyone. All right. Okay. So on the y-axis is the SNP frequency, on the x-axis is the variant of interest frequency. So this is the actual quantitative trait locus that we're interested in.
Okay, but I guess a quantitative trait is a number. It's not, it doesn't have a frequency. I guess that's what I'm confused about. I mean, it could be 0 to 10% or...
But I mean, still, you're... Okay, it's not the frequency of the trait. It's the frequency of the trait locus. So let's say go back to the serotonin transporter as an example. If we were looking at SNPs that were associated with the serotonin transporter, they would be on the y-axis. The frequency of the alleles at the serotonin transporter, that is the gene of interest, the trait variant of interest, is what's on the x-axis.
The actual gene.
The actual gene. That's what we. Yeah, so that's what we would call the QTL, the trait locus.
Okay, one more quick practical question, because I think it actually is relevant if anyone actually does have models genes, or you might be asked to model so they believe. The simplest thing is actually just kind of including a covariate, which is the number of the allele count, basically. And so that's an additive model.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess, is there any conventional wisdom as to when you should be using a dominant or recessive model or a full genotypic model, which will be a two-degree of freedom model that allows any sort of variation?
You know, I think there really isn't. I think it's a big point of debate at the moment. I mean, if you look at most genome-wide association studies at this point, they just use additive models because it's simpler.
Okay.
So...
All right, let's thank Nelson again.
Thank you.